Monster Man, Special Episode, Sea Serpents. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer, Katie. If you'd like to be like Katie and get your own special episode of Monster Man, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do, in addition to your own special extra-long episode about a monster of your choice, you'll also get access to my other show, Patron Deities, as well as all other rewards available at the $1 and $2 levels. So Katie, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy the episode. The term sea serpent encompasses a number of different creatures, and I think it's easiest to think of it as a catch-all category of non-specific sea monster. Indeed, some sea serpents aren't really sea serpents at all. Probably the most famous aquatic monster is the Loch Ness Monster. I think that we can take these creatures and we can divide them into three broad categories. Perhaps I should say that we can divide them into at least three broad categories, because I think there are actually probably rather more of them. I haven't really touched on, you could consider a lot of dragons in Chinese mythology to be what might be considered sea serpents, given their association with water. Maybe it's better to say that I want to look at three categories of sea serpent. First, we've got, let's call it the biblical sea serpent. Here we're talking about Leviathan. And Leviathan is both a very large sea creature and a symbol of the primordial and sort of unknowable power of nature. When God wants to demonstrate his dominion over creation, one of the symbols that he often uses is his ability to conquer Leviathan. Canst thou draw out the Leviathan with an hook? Another example of this might be the conflict between Marduk and Tiamat in the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation myth, where the snaky-ish, watery monster is again the symbol of the primordial chaos that reigned before the ordered social world created by Marduk. The next is the here there be dragons on the map type sea serpent. There I think we can see it both in the kind of like sailor's tail form, in the form written about by ancient and medieval geographers, and in those illustrations that fill in the empty spaces on maps. And then thirdly and finally, we have the modern sea monster. This is the sea monster cryptid, the type of sea monster proposed by people who might believe that sea monsters really exist. There are a number of different modern sea serpent stories, although I think that these days we're more likely to see these in the form of lake and river cryptids. Things like the Loch Ness Monster or Champ or Ogopogo or what have you. So at first glance, it does not seem like these three categories of monster have very much in common. I think what they have in common is ultimately the combined symbolism of snakes and, maybe not even just snakes, but, the snake and the dragon and the sea. In something or other, I want to say that it was actually in the D20 Call of Cthulhu rulebook. I'm sorry, I'm going to put in a sidebar here. The D20 Call of Cthulhu game gets a bad rap. On a strictly mechanical level, it is a profoundly unnecessary game. It was released, in that like late 90s, early 2000s, whatever it was, mania for absolutely everything. 2000, I think is when it came out. Mania for making a D20 version of absolutely everything. And it just doesn't, there's nothing that it does in a strictly rules sense that Call of Cthulhu doesn't also do, except, I guess, be accessible to people who've only played D&D and make D&D monsters, or make a Cthulhu monsters available for your D&D game. I guess those are both good things. But what it does have is a really quite strong Keeper's Advice section. And I think if you can find that book at a cheap price, it's actually worth reading it just for the sort of advice on the way the games are, way that kind of investigative horror games are designed. I wouldn't run the game as written, But, you know, a lot of people dismiss it on a conceptual level, and I think it is a bad idea, or at least a bit of a pointless idea, but it's a very well-executed version of that idea. Anyway, this is a very roundabout way of saying that in it, I want to say that John Scott Tynes wrote the section in which he says, "The sea is a secret." In many ways, the sea has some of the same symbolism as the underworld. We know that the underground spaces of the world are like dreams, and they're like death, and they're unknowable, fundamentally. And the sea is the greatest symbol of what is unknowable. If you're not a mountaineering type, and there's a whole thing about, like, the sort of spiritual meaning of mountaineering in the Romantic era. I read a book about this once. But I think for most people, the sea is the biggest thing that they've ever encountered, right? Other than space, and we feel the same way about space. The sea is something that is beyond our scale, and it's vast, it's deep. I mean, we use the word profound, and what that means is that we believe that the sea could be full of unknowable things in a way that we don't really believe that the city is full of unknowable things, or even that farmland is full of unknowable things. If you were going to put an eruption into our reality of another reality, you would put it in the deep sea. That seems like the best place for it. So the sea symbolizes the unknown. It represents the unknown, but also it is the unknown. If you're going to have cryptid-type monsters, the deep sea seems like a good place for them because there is, in many ways, so little that we know about the life of the sea compared to other parts of the world. This means that sea serpents have a tremendously powerful meaning for players, but in a fantasy adventure game, they are actually quite difficult to implement effectively. I'm taking some of my information here, a lot of my thinking has been inspired by the book Sea Monsters on Medieval and Renaissance Maps by Chet Van Duzer. Van Duzer calls the monsters that appear on these maps data points in the geography of the marvelous, as well as decorative images, that in some cases, the monsters that appear on medieval and Renaissance maps represent stories about those monsters that exist, say, in the Bible or in works of classical geography. But in other cases, they're merely decorative. Probably the most famous sea monster map, and one that I don't currently have on my study wall, but if I went outside the door of the room I'm recording in, I'd see it hanging up, is Olaus Magnus's Carta Marina, or the Carta Marina Scandinavia, it's sometimes called. And that does have a number of sea monsters, including sea serpents on it, and some of the most common types, including the monster where everyone like lands on its back and they think it's an island, and as a genuine sea serpent attacking a ship. These sea monsters represented areas that were beyond the limits of the map, literally in some cases, because those mapmakers had to know that the world did not end where the map ended. And yet, maps in the Middle Ages often are more about representing the ideas of the medieval cosmology than they are providing geographic reference for travelers. If you look at the maps of the 13th century English, well, he was French, but he was working in England, monk Matthew Paris, he does this map of Britain where he labels the Atlantic Ocean, you know, up to the north and west. He says, quote, "a vast sea where there is nothing but the abode of monsters," close quotes. So that's just some fun sea monster trivia. Okay, let's talk about using them in games. The first challenge that the sea monster poses for the game master is that that whole thing about the unknowability of monsters works very differently in our world than it does in the world of a fantasy role-playing game. Because, of course, in a fantasy RPG, monsters may not be something that's weird and unfamiliar. So if you're playing that kind of, you know, medieval horror-type game, almost, where every time a monster is encountered, it is unique, then the idea that monsters can live in this part of the world and nobody believes the superstitious sailors and ships are lost at sea all the time and whatever, you know, that adds some kind of frisson to it. But if you are in a sort of standard D&D campaign, it's really weird to have people talking about like, oh, this area of the map's inhabited by sea monsters, And like, it sort of loses some of its sense of weirdness and exoticism because, of course, yeah, no kidding, like every area of the map is inhabited by monsters. Loses some of its punch. But what that means is that, under those circumstances, the presence of the sea monster is reduced to being only, rather than partially, a tactical problem. If we are fighting a sea monster in a game where the rarity of monsters is maintained, then we are not only fighting a sea monster, but we are fighting something that reveals that our understanding of the world is not necessarily correct. But there's no D&D party where people are like, ah, yes, let's get on this boat, and the sailors are like, yar, me hearty, we be sailing into the waters of the great sea serpent. And the PCs go, sea serpents? I don't believe they exist. Right? They live in a world where monsters are all over the place. Now, there are two ways around this. The first is to rely on the player's instincts to reinforce genre tropes. I've mentioned this before in the context of things like vampires, where player characters in a scenario with a vampire in it will start replicating gothic horror tropes because they understand that they are making a shift into a gothic horror narrative. So if you add a sea serpent and we know that we're entering sea story territory and everybody's about to get their Patrick O'Brien on for a little while, I think there is some willingness to play along with that, even though on a strictly in-game level, it doesn't necessarily make an enormous amount of sense for these people to be upset about a sea serpent in a way that they don't appear to get upset about all the giant birds and giant other monsters that are around them all the time. The second is to make your sea monsters real weird. You know, don't just make them very big snakes that live in the sea, but make them strange existential threats of some kind. I think if you have that, you know, if you go to the myth of a sea serpent and you look at the Midgarth serpent, Jormungandr, is often depicted, you know, encircling the earth, maybe even biting its own tail. Leviathan is often depicted that way too. If you're dealing with something that exists on that super scale, then the sense of awe and mystery that your sea serpent should have can still continue to exist. The other problem is that when reduced to a purely tactical problem, sea serpents don't really provide interesting tactical problems. One of the reasons that Dungeons & Dragons has so many, you know, dungeons is that the complexities of the built environment make for an easy way to change the settings of encounters and make them interesting. You can fight the same monsters, but it's made more interesting by the fact that you are doing it in different environments, but on a boat, you don't really have that same thing. Indeed, the tactics of a boat fight tend not to be very interesting because you're almost certainly dealing with a monster that is too large for you to cut it in half with your broadsword or whatever. So essentially, what you're going to be doing is standing on the ship, shooting at it or launching spells at it until it, you know, wraps its coils around the ship and, you know, closes into hand strokes, at which point you run up and have a go with your great axe. Or you beck to Corbin. Unless the players are themselves steering the ship, and there are better ship rules than most versions of D&D have, you are ultimately not really making interesting tactical decisions. It's going to be a toe-to-toe slugfest that ends when the monster runs away or you die. You know, I am not like a gamer who plays primarily for the tactical challenge, but I do like a little bit of a tactical challenge. I like being able to feel clever and outwit my opponents and be observant and make use of the landscape around me, and I don't usually like toe-to-toe fights because they seem to me more like a foregone conclusion. You just compare stats and whoever's got the better stats wins. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of ship battles where you are fighting against something that is on a ship scale end up being like that, particularly when you, the ship, are at the mercy of the wind, and the sea serpent probably isn't. So again, I think that this is a challenge that can be avoided if you present the sea serpent in an interesting way. One way of doing this, for example, would be to present it as like a mobility challenge, a strategic challenge rather than a tactical one. So this sea serpent is blocking the entrance to the harbor. We need to find some way to get into the city, but we can't just go sailing right in because the sea serpent will mess us up. We need to come up with an alternative plan. A related example would be the idea that the sea serpent is under the control of some enemy. So then the tactical challenge is replaced essentially by a moral dilemma. That is, that I am not necessarily interested in fighting and killing this thing that, you know, has not intentionally done me any wrong. It also allows you to do the thing that you really want to do with an impossibly powerful monster and threaten to deploy it rather than actually deploying it. Really big monsters are often more interesting in potentia than they are in reality. You could insert it into your cosmology in a way that makes sense. So, for example, you could argue that dragons and sea serpents are kind of two sides of the same coin, you know, fire and water. You could introduce a sea serpent as an ally or a mode of transportation. So if sea serpents are not very interesting to fight, then it only makes sense that you would have to not fight them. But maybe, you know, the way in which you communicate with the sea serpent is that you have to, you know, dive into some sunken temple of ancient Atlantis and retrieve certain stones carved with weird sigils. You know, maybe it's a Gamera type situation where, like, you can communicate with the thing, but not, like, super effectively. This also gives you some kind of, like, race against time or blockade running thing. That stuff interests me in a theoretical sense, but I feel like most games don't have the ship rules that allow you to do them. One standout example of this, although it's about a whale rather than a sea serpent, is Genial Jack, which I've had cause to mention on this podcast before, but which is a whole setting written by Jonathan Newell that takes place in the Balleon on the back of a giant whale. So transform that into another type of sea monster, and you could have that weird world as a setting almost. And, you know, that kind of plays with a lot of the tropes of things being swallowed whole, kind of like in Pinocchio or the story of Jonah and the whale. I feel like that's got some kind of merit to it. This, the sea serpent as a force under someone's control, sort of, but not quite, or as your ally, person you rely on, maybe not necessarily super trustworthy. Finally, you could go with the idea of the sea serpent as the expression of primordial chaos. That once you get out into that particular edge of the ocean where mighty serpents, you know, hundreds of ships' lengths long writhe in the crashing waves, and there's not even any pattern to the swell, but just the sea is bucking and writhing and striking out in all directions simultaneously. Once you're there, the presence of the great serpents is itself a sign that you're not in Kansas anymore, that you've left the norms of the world that you know behind. I have never been a big one for maritime adventure sequences. I don't mean like adventure sequences set at sea, but I mean specifically like storm sequences and things like that. It's weird, I've read all these Patrick O'Brien books, so I don't seem to like that kind of thing, because he does have an awful lot of it, but somehow it's true. So it may be that when I look at that kind of situation and go, well, that's fun, but it's not narratively interesting. It's not that it doesn't have narrative tension. It's that the resolution of the narrative tension, there is a storm and you might get shipwrecked, doesn't lead you anywhere. You're either shipwrecked or you're not. Honestly, being shipwrecked is the more interesting outcome, but you're probably not going to get a sea serpent into your story of castaways on a desert island. Although it could be the reason that the rescue ships can't arrive. That'd be kind of neat, actually. What if there is a big sea serpent that kind of like makes its nest in the lagoon of this island upon which you've been shipwrecked, and you know that this is a relatively busy shipping lane, and you can build a signal fire and summon some passing galleon over to pick you up and take you away, but there's a sea serpent, and you can't just signal the ship or else it'll attack it. Ooh, and what if they collect hordes like dragons, only it's, you know, sunken pirate treasure? That sound means that we have reached the traditional element of the Monster Man show. If you're playing the Monster Man drinking game, which doesn't exist, but if you were playing a Monster Man drinking game, you'd take a drink here, because it is James has talked himself into liking a monster that he's not that enthusiastic about generally. Because there you got a sea serpent that's, maybe you could even say like, oh yeah, there are these huge sea serpents out in the open waves, but when they're young, because they can't, you know, withstand the dangers of the open sea, they make their like temporary nests in lagoons. But young, these are very long-lived creatures, so those young periods last for a long time. So this island is kind of off limits to the sea serpent. Oh, and that would explain why whatever, you know, whatever crazy nonsense is there has not been found by other explorers, because every so often the mommy sea serpent comes home. I tell you, another thing you could do is give them some kind of elemental powers. I like the idea that the sea serpents almost cause the storm by rolling and crashing in their watery beds. You know, if they are expressions of the primordial forces of nature at sea, then it seems to make sense that they'd be associated with storms. So primordial forces of nature, primordial forces of the human unconscious, or just big water monsters to have a fun fight with. I think all of those are possible in a fantasy RPG. Me, I like the primordial forces of chaos monster, but then that's just kind of the sort of thing that I go for. So Katie, I hope that you enjoyed this episode all about sea serpents. If you'd like to be like Katie and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or you can pledge at a lower level if you prefer. If you don't want the episode, I'm not the boss of you. In our next episode, we will be returning to the Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for basic Dungeons & Dragons. And we're going to be talking about the Fundamental and the Gargoyle, Iron, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.